Again, it's good to have each of you out this evening. We are going to continue the lesson that we had this morning. We were talking about the denominations and where they came from and basically a little bit of the history of that. I did warn that I have a lot of notes. I managed to get through 2 pages of my 11 pages. So it might be a while before I finish this off. Though we'll see how fast we go through this evening. One of the points that I want to reiterate for those that weren't here this morning that we want to make sure we understand is that the early disciples decided things based on the scriptures. They used the Bible as their guidebook. And that was the decisions that were made. But over the years, people started having developed other ideas and other concepts. And in dealing with those and trying to refute them, they came up with creeds to try to get everybody back into line. But those creeds themselves then became a problem because then they were relying on other things other than the Bible as this source of it. Over the years, we got up to about 1000 AD. We have a split between the Roman Catholic Church, who had a catechism to teach people what they believed, versus the Orthodox churches. This one's Russian Orthodox, had their liturgy that was then to teach people what Russian Orthodoxism is versus Roman Catholicism. And so that's where we got up to. In the Middle Ages, when we get to that period of time, sometimes referred to as the Dark Ages, the Roman Catholic Church grew to be a very, very powerful organization. It made and put kings in places and controlled a lot of countries. But at the same time, it became extremely corrupt. I got some very interesting books about that period of time. We're not going to get into it, but it was a time that it's basically kind of hard to grasp. There were thousands of people that were put to death because they disagreed with the Roman Catholic Church. And sometimes it was for simply owning a Bible they were put to death. Because the Roman Catholic Church had this philosophy, they taught everything in Latin. Well, most people in Europe didn't speak Latin. That meant the church then controlled all access to religion. And so they didn't want a Bible in the common people's hands. And so when people started to try to translate it into native tongues, that brought the wrath of the church on top of them. And a lot of people were put to death because of that. Because of this opposition by the church to anything that was even mentioned that was different, people started to oppose the church in droves, especially in the later part of the Middle Ages. Probably the most famous protest was that led by Martin Luther. Martin Luther was a priest. He studied to be a priest. And as he studied, he realized there was a lot of things wrong with Roman Catholicism. And his initial attempt was to try to reform the church. He just wanted them to fix the problems. But he was met by a lot of opposition. And so he wrote his objections. He nailed it to the door of a church in Wittenberg, Germany in 1517. That resulted in his being excommunicated from the Roman Catholic Church in 1520, which then led to him forming a church that became known as the Lutheran Church. Actually, Luther begged his followers not to use his name, but they persisted and did it anyway. The teachings that he did were formalized into a set of documents that are called Luther's Catechism, as opposed to the Roman Catholic Catechism. Now, Luther's opposition did eventually caused reforms to take place. It wasn't that it was a bad thing. The Roman Catholic Church not only Luther, but there's a number of others we're going to talk about here just briefly. Because all of that went on, the Roman Catholic Church looked and finally said, you know what, we got to do something. And they did do a lot of reforms, but it took literally over 100 years, almost 150 years before they finally stopped doing some of the worst of their practices. One of the things about Martin Luther and his opposing Roman Catholic's idea of salvation, see, the Roman Catholics by this time saw salvation as totally by works. It was all rituals. It was all the things you did in church and things like that, that they saw that as the way you got saved. Well, Martin Luther said, no, there's a spiritual aspect to this. But in opposing Roman Catholicism, he went to the other extreme. And he taught that salvation was by faith alone. And faith is a major element of salvation. And you cannot be saved without faith. But the Bible teaches that we're saved by an obedient faith. Take a look at Romans chapter 16. Romans chapter 16. And starting with verse 26. It says, now is manifest and by the scriptures of the prophets, according to the commandment of the eternal God, has been made known to all the nations, leading to the obedience of faith. To the only wise God through Jesus Christ be glory forever. Amen. There is an obedience of faith. It's not just faith. It's not just works. It's both working together. They're two sides of the same coin in a sense. In fact, specifically, the Bible says we're not saved by faith alone. In James chapter 2, James chapter 2 and verse 24, it says, you see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. Now, James is not saying it's works alone. Not even close. He's saying, though, it's not faith alone. And it wouldn't be works alone either. But that's the point that James is trying to get across. In fact, Martin Luther had such a trouble with this particular passage that he at times doubted whether James was actually inspired, because it contradicted what he thought was what the scriptures actually taught. But that led to the Lutheran. And if you look at Lutheran services and their practices, they have a lot of similarities to Roman Catholicism. But they're different, because the emphasis is not on the rituals, it's on the faith that's in there. But a lot of the other things, they kept a lot of the same type of traditions that you find. Now, in that same era, over in England, this Martin Luther was in Germany, about the same time period. Now we're going over to England. Henry VIII was king of England. And he was married to a woman named Catherine of Aragon. She was the widow of his older brother. And she was the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain. Those are the people that you probably remember financed Columbus's voyage over to the what turned out to be the New World. Well, Catherine produced no male heirs for the throne. And so Henry decided he wanted out of the marriage. So he petitioned the Pope for an annulment, because the Roman Catholic Church doesn't grant divorces, they're annulments, even though they're basically the same thing. The problem was, though, Catherine's nephew, Charles V, was the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire at that time. And the Roman Catholic Church is the center of that empire. And so he advised the Pope, don't grant the annulment. And, of course, the Pope listened to Charles. Meanwhile, Henry met a woman named Anne Boleyn. He got tired of waiting. So he decided to break off from the Roman Catholic Church and set up his own church and place himself as head. He figured, well, he's head of the country, he can be head of a church, right? Why not? And as a result, then he could do as he wished. And as he wished meant that he no longer was married to Catherine. In fact, he ended up marrying 6 times. And he had 4 of his wives beheaded. But in the process to get to that point, he set up this church and he called it the Church of England. And to clarify its beliefs, they had a book called the Book of Common Prayers. I would add it to my stack, but I don't have that one in my collection. It was first written in 1549. And it spread to other countries. And in the other countries, it became known as the Anglican Church, because that was another way to refer to the English. They were Anglicans. So this was the Anglican Church, except for in the U.S. See, the problem is in the United States, there was so much hatred for British people because after the Revolutionary War. That group changed its name to the Episcopal Church. Everywhere else, they call it the Anglican Church, but in the U.S., they call it the Episcopal Church because back in the Revolutionary War time, nobody liked Anglicans, British. So this one is interesting because this church wasn't started because of differences in religious beliefs. The Anglican Church actually retained many Roman Catholic practices and beliefs. It just basically was a British version of the Roman Catholic Church. Meanwhile, we now go jump over to Switzerland. And this is happening about the same era, same time period. There was a man named John Calvin. He too, like Luther, led a Reformation. And like Luther, his initial attempt was trying to reform the Roman Catholic Church. And when it failed for him, he also formed a new church. And that church was known as the Presbyterian Church. Presbyter is for elders. It's the Greek word for elders. So it was a church that was run by elders. And they used Calvin's Institutes for the Christian Religion that was published in 1536. Calvin's, if you wanted to really sum up Calvin's ideas, they really centralize on the idea that God is completely sovereign. To the extent that God predestined some people to be saved while others are lost, because God chose everything from before they made the world. In a sense, from Calvin's viewpoint, all of our lives are nothing more than pre-programmed. We're following the script of a play that was written before the world began. And we have no other choice. The problem, though, is it doesn't match what the Bible teaches. Take a look at Jeremiah 7. In Jeremiah 7, there's an interesting statement by God. Jeremiah 7, verse 31. Talking about the people of Judah, he said, they have built the high places, a Topheth, which is in the valley of the sons of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I did not command, and it did not come into my mind. That's an interesting statement. God said, I would never have even thought of asking anybody to do that. Well, if everything's pre-programmed, and we're just following a script that God designed before the world began, How is it that people did think something that God never thought? Never even enter his mind? To command or say? How could it be predestined? And then there's also the problem of a statement in John chapter 7. John chapter 7 and verse 17. Jesus says, if anyone is willing to do his will, he will know of the teaching, whether it is of God and or whether I speak from myself. Now notice it. If anyone is willing. Well, willing means that I have a choice. What if I'm not willing? Well, then I won't learn from God, that obviously, but that means I have a choice whether I learn or not. Again, that conflicts with the idea that God's so sovereign, nobody has a choice, God picks, and that's what's going to happen. Now, of course, a new denomination also needs a document defining it, and for the Presbyterians, that's a document is called the Westminster Confession of Faith. It's a document that defines what the Presbyterian Church is. And again, it's actually not all that long, but I don't have a copy of it with me. But again, we have yet another document. Now going back to England. For a long while, there were groups in England and Europe that abandoned Roman Catholicism totally. And they went for the simple worship that was found in the Bible. About this time, actual English versions of Bibles were being printed. And they were kind of secretly being distributed among people. And people were reading for themselves, and they were actually leaving the Church of England and Roman Catholic Church by droves. Not huge enough to make a large number of people upset, but big enough that people noticed and people were being put to death for owning these English Bibles or written in other languages. So we're not going to get into those little small groups, but what we're interested in is that among the many beliefs that these groups rejected was the idea of infant baptism. They said, no, baptism is after you believe and after you have repented. That is for adults. And it's based on faith. But in a world that's influenced by Roman Catholicism, that was seen as condemning children to death, to hell. Because they saw that they believed you were born sinful. That's been taught since Augustine's days, that you are born sinful, and so if you want your child to get to heaven, you have to have them baptized when they're born. Otherwise, they won't make it to heaven. And so for a group to say infant baptism's wrong and doesn't practice it, well, they looked at it saying, you're condemning children. And that made people very upset. One also thing that was kind of interesting is that by this time period, the Roman Catholics had totally abandoned baptism by immersion. They only did sprinkling. Some did pouring. But for the most part, it was totally abandoned. These groups were actually immersing people in water. In fact, take a look at Acts chapter 8 and verse 38. Acts chapter 8 and verse 38. He says, and he ordered the chariot to stop, and they both went down into the water, Philip as well as the eunuch, and he baptized him. And when they came up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord snatched Philip away, and the eunuch saw him no longer, but went on his way rejoicing. This is a description of what baptism was. And this is what these churches were practicing. Usually there's a gentleman named John Smith, or Smythe. I don't know how you pronounce it when you spell it that way. But John Smith is usually cited as the founder of the Baptist Church. But as I was digging through the histories of it, if you go look at the non-Baptist historical accounts, it's actually not that hard to show that he was a part of the Church of England, but he left the church. He actually was baptized by one of these small groups, by immersion. It actually talks about him walking 2 miles in soaking wet clothes after he was baptized. And he actually then withdrew and started preaching and with a church that was one of these splinter groups. Pressure was put on the group, and so they left and went into Europe, to Amsterdam particularly. Unfortunately, John Smith decided that he changed his mind. He decided his baptism was invalid because he decided that the Church of England, as well as the Roman Catholics preach, this idea of successionism, where you have to have somebody who can basically get a chain all the way back to the original apostles. And he decided that a baptism is not valid unless you have somebody that was a part of that chain that goes all the way back. And so he rebaptized himself because he was used to be a part of the Church of England, so he could claim the successes. And so he was going to start a new chain. Well, for that, he got withdrawn from by the church that was in Amsterdam that he brought over. He tried to join the Mennonites, and they didn't like what he was teaching either. And he ended up dying before any of that got resolved. So I don't know exactly why the Baptists want to say that was the start, because the group he had joined had pre-existed him. One of his followers took over that church, moved it back into England. And again, there's documents that show that a lot of their teachings and their beliefs are more different from the Baptists than you would expect. But jump forward about another 15, 20, 25 years, and you start seeing a change in the teachings. And about that time, there rose a group that was called the General Baptist. And so they were called, I forgot the reason why they called them general. It was general because I think it was for all people. And it was different from another group of Baptists who were more Calvinistic in their beliefs. And they were called peculiar Baptists. And there was yet a third group of Baptists at that time also arising. So you had really three groups of Baptist groups showing up at once. Initially, they didn't call themselves Baptists. So it's really the more liberal elements of these splinter groups that eventually over the decades became Baptists. And it really wasn't heavily used until about almost the 1700s before that name got started being used a lot. One of the quotes I found says, "The Baptist movement was born in the midst of the fervent and evolution of the English church in the 17th century. Originally a collection of hole-in-the-wall dissenters who were easily confused with seekers, ranters, Quakers, and political anarchists, Baptists rose to positions of prominence and respectability by 1700 in England and Wales." And that's from a book, that's from an article in Christianity Today called A People Called Baptist. A Baptist historian named Chris Trendisett, in a primer on Baptist history, said by 1624 there were 5 known General Baptist churches, and by 1650 they were numbered at least 47. Now, it's important to note because one aspect of John Smith kind of did influence them is this idea of successionalism. I've run across a lot, they want to claim that there were groups earlier then the Baptists really started, because they really wanted to say that they were there from all the way from the beginning. Even though their teachings are different. You can't, if you take Baptist teachings and say, where does this come from? It's different. But if you remember, one group of the Baptists that were arising were heavily influenced by Calvin's teachings. And they kind of merged together. And so one of the things that started being taught is this idea that once a person's saved, he cannot be lost. Because if God picks you, well, then you're picked. You can't be unpicked, is where this started rising. There's a manual that's called the Standard Manual for Baptist Churches. It's not their official creed. Each of the various branches of Baptists have their own different documents. But it's pretty good for defining what Baptists believes in general are. And Hiscott said, "We believe the scriptures teach that such as are truly regenerated, being born of the Spirit, will not utterly fall away and perish." Sam Morris, who's a was a pastor at the First Baptist Church in Sanford, Texas, he wrote a tract that was called "The Discussion Which Involves a Subject Pertinent to All Men." And after going through a whole list of sins like fornication and murder and things like that, and saying that none of these would keep a person out of heaven, he says, "The way a man lives has nothing to do with the salvation of his soul. If you're saved, it doesn't matter what you do. You're saved." But compare this to John 15. In John chapter 15, starting with verse 1. "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, he prunes it so that it may bear more fruit. You are already clean because of the word which I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As a branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, so neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, and you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him, he bears much fruit, for apart from me you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away as a branch and dries up, and they gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burnt. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. My Father is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit, and so prove to be my disciples." Now notice what Jesus is saying. He's saying that if you stay within his teaching, within the vine, you stay with him, you'll bear fruit. You don't, well, that means you're already in. You get cut off and discarded. Or another verse that considers, Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 12. It says, "Take care, brethren, that there be not in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God." He calls them brethren and warns them that if you develop an evil heart, you'll fall away from God. This is not what was being taught by the Baptists. It's funny that, you know, the Baptist church started out with people baptizing and insisting that it was for adults who had proper faith and had properly repented of their sins. But eventually they changed their mind about baptism. And again, in Hiscock's Standard Manual for Baptist Churches, this one comes from page 22, it says, "It is most likely that in the apostolic age, when there was but one Lord, one faith, and one baptism, and no differing denominations existed, baptism was the door into the church. Now it is different. The churches therefore have candidates give their experience, and then their reception is decided by a vote of the members. Notice it says, now it's different. Why? Why should it be different? Why? Jesus hasn't issued another Bible. And so this is where the Baptists have arisen. It started out in England and spread across the world into America and the rest. About the time the Baptists were really getting going well, so we're getting up into the 1700s. In 1729, there was a man named Charles Wesley. He was a student at Oxford. And he was dissatisfied with the formal ritualism that was in the Church of England. Remember, they basically just lifted out Roman Catholicism and changed it to English. And he was dissatisfied with that ritualism. And so he formed a holy club in Oxford with fellow students. Eventually, his brother John Wesley joined them. And they established a set of rules of which they were going to improve their spiritual lives. And it all started out sounding really good. And so they had various sets of rules that they were going to follow every day so that they would become more holy. Now, the fellow students taunted them and called them Methodists because they were following the methods, the rules, on a daily basis. John decided to turn that around, and instead of taking that as a taunt, accepted that as their name. And it became known as the Methodists. That list of rules became a book called The Methodist Discipline. And in that Methodist discipline, you can find a quote where it says, "We have therefore expected that the discipline would be administered not merely as a legal document, but as a revelation of the Holy Spirit working in and through our people." Now notice what they're saying. It's a revelation. They're saying it's inspired by God. They're no longer just saying, "Hey, we wrote some books, documents, and we want you to believe them." The Methodists went one step a little bit further and said, "No, ours is actually inspired by God." And thus they placed man-made documents on the same level as the Bible. It started out, actually, the Methodists actually started out as basically a sect within the Church of England. And they worked within the same group. Eventually, though, it gradually, because the differences in beliefs, it kind of, over the years, started diverging and became its own denomination by the late 1700s and early 1800s. So taking us, looking at the time. I got up to the 1800s. But the next section is long, because I'm going to talk about Mormonism next, because that arose during the early 1800s. I think I'm going to pause there and continue on then. Lord willing, next week, I'll continue this lesson on Sunday morning, and we'll see if I can get it done by then. But until that time, we'd like to offer an opportunity that if there is anyone, again, who's here tonight, who wishes to live by the standards that God has given us, there's no better time than right now to put on Christ. And for those of you who are children of God and would like to pray as your brother on behalf, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song that's selected.